Good morning, colleagues. Could I call the meeting to order, please? Before we order a business, could they read out the normal statutory wording? I've had a two-pager. We managed to get reduced to one now, so I'll be a bit more brief than before. This meeting of the Midlothian Council will be broadcast live to the internet and will be stored as part of the Council's webcast archive. I have the discretion to terminate or suspend filming if, in my opinion, allowing filming to continue would prejudice the proceedings of the meeting. Equally so, items that are heard in private will not be made available to the public. Members are reminded that the cameras are activated by the sound system and that they must be switched on microphones, sorry, when speaking and off when finished. Right, thank you. Could I have the order of business, please?
Thanks, Provost. The agenda is as per the pack that's been previously circulated with the following amendments. I understand that the following motions have now been withdrawn. Those are items 7.1 and 7.2 on today's agenda, and I would request that the proposers of those motions could confirm that they're happy to proceed on that basis. Thanks, Provost.
Councillor Winchester, that's okay, right, thank you. Could I just, before I actually go, could I welcome Alistair Short to his first meeting as the Joint Director of Health and Social Care. You have been here before, so it's not a new experience for you, but just welcome to your new position. Okay, right, thanks for that. Right, we're done order of business. Declarations of interest? None. If there's, as normal, if there's any as you're going along, if you feel there are any declarations you need to make, you can come on in a specific item. Okay, thanks for that. Deputations? There's no deputations. Minutes of the previous meeting. Approval is a correct record. Note of the meeting.
I just have a couple of points to raise in the meeting's previous minutes.
That's okay. I've got one as well. On you go then, Councillor Parry.
I have three, if that's all right. In the meeting of the special council, there's an incorrection in the paper on workforce strategy. I think it's just a repeat. It said that I had moved a recommendation to state maintain a commitment to avoiding compulsory redundancies. It was actually the second part that I had moved, and I'm happy to give the clerk the correct wording of that. The second point was in the financial strategy, there was a set of proposals put forward by the Conservatives, and the minutes state that they would be costed and then be included in the consultation. It would be good if we could know if those have been costed, when councillors can expect the detail, and when they will be included in the consultation.
That you? That's all right. Okay. Well, do you want to do your third one and I can answer them?
The third point was, again, in the financial paper on page 27 of our pack. Councillor Muirhead had raised an issue around community facilities in Mayfield and Newton Grange and had queried some of the budget projections for those, which was absolutely the right thing to do. However, after that, there was some heated discussions, and in fact, on social media, I saw Councillor Hackett claim that there had been a secret decision made, and further that there was a decision made either by councillors or officers not to minute that decision, and that somehow a decision had been taken in secret. And I think it would be good if we could get some clarification as to what has actually happened. I know there's been various correspondence between me and officers, and I'm sure the Labour councillors would like the same clarification. I'm sure the community would as well. But it would be good to know that that there has been no other decisions made since 2013 on those specific facilities, and it's my understanding that any subsequent decisions would have to come back to full council, and that they intend to do so in 2018, but that hasn't happened yet.
Okay, I'm not sure what officers yourself, Kenneth.
Thank you. If I can pick up on the second and third points, in relation to the Conservative Group proposals, recommendation M on the minutes of the 10th of October, item 5.1. Work has been done by officers in respect of that. We have met with the Conservative Group to clarify certain issues, and in line with the minute, there will be a report back to the Business Transformation Steering Group, so that work is in hand. In relation to your third point and community facilities, there has been a great deal of correspondence about this since the previous council meeting. What I have requested is that the relevant officers pull together a report showing all the timescales and the decisions taken. That will also come back into the Business Transformation Steering Group, and then that can inform the financial strategy report, which will come to the Council in December.
Okay, if that answers your two questions, and you're going to pass on the information to Kyle for the correction in the minutes, if that's for approved. Okay. Right, thanks for that. There's one other item on the minutes of the meeting. I was asked to write to the MP regarding Glencoe's Barracks motion. I did that, and I subsequently met with her, and she's quite happy to continue the process of support and retention of the barracks. So, I mean, it's not any more complicated than that. Okay. Right, thank you. Any other items in the minutes? Oh, Kenneth. Right.
Thank you, Provost. It's just a couple of simple typos in the motion 7.3 for the paperless meetings. There's just two typos, one in the first sentence and one in the last sentence.
Do you want to read them out for us, please?
Yeah, sure.
Because they might be different in the paper copies. So
I wouldn't know, Adam. I wouldn't know. So the first line states Midlothian Council commits to paperless council and committee meetings by the end of 2017, where it should say by the end of 2017. The last one is a strict policy against the unnecessary expense would be a great benefit to Midlothian Council. It should be a strict policy against this unnecessary expense. That's it. And major.
Any problems with changing the minutes to accommodate that? Okay, right, thanks for that. Any other items in the minutes? No? Okay. We need to approve them, yeah, I know. So we need to approve the minutes of the Midlothian Council as have been amended here today of the 26th of September. Could I have a mover and a seconder, please? Councillor Mulligan, seconded. Councillor Hackett. The addendum to the minute on the 26th of September 2017, could I have approval for that? Councillor Mulligan. Councillor Hackett, before you put your hand up, right? And the note of the special meeting of Midlothian Council of the 10th of October 2017 for approval. Councillor Mulligan and Councillor Hackett. Right, thanks for that. And the other minutes for approval, we don't need a mover and a seconder. The Cabinet of the 15th of August 2017 for approval. If there's any items you want to raise, just shout out. Special Cabinet, 21st of August 2017. Planning Committee, 22nd of August 2017. General Purposes Committee, 22nd of August 2017. Local Review Body, 29th of August 2017. Audit Committee, 20th of June 2017. Midlothian Integration Joint Board, 24th of August 2017. And the Special Midlothian Integration Board, 14th of September 2017. Okay, all these are for approval. Okay, right, thanks for that. Right, questions to the Leader of the Council. We have a written question to the Leader from Councillor Winchester, and I think there is a written response.
Provost, there's a written response. My apologies for this slipping off the radar for as long. We now have an agreed timescale. We met yesterday with Councillor Parry and Winchester, and we've agreed a timescale to take this forward. And again, my apologies for this slipping.
Okay. That's the written response. Right, thanks for that, Derek. We're on to motions. As has been indicated, 7.1 and 7.2 have been withdrawn. We're now on to motion number 3 from Councillor Sardy and Munro.
Thank you, Provost. I'm putting forward a motion today for us to withdraw from COSLA, thereby by saving £64,945 per year, which would be a saving of roughly £325,000 over the five-year period. Council, I think it's essential for all of us as councillors to first accept that the council is in a precarious financial position and that we need to make cuts. But also as representatives of the people in our wards, we need to accept that we need to make cuts that avoid cutting jobs and frontline services across our wards. These services are essential and our constituents expect us to do everything we can to protect these services. The money that we spend on COSLA would be better spent protecting the vital services that our constituents need and pay for. And I believe that I don't think any of us can truly look our constituents in the eye and say that we have done everything we can to mitigate the cuts to essential services in our communities if we're still spending money on talking shops for councillors where there are free meals and expenses, and we're cutting jobs and services across the county. So I put it to you, Council, that we should move to withdraw from COSLA and show that we're serious about making cuts and protecting services and jobs across Midlothian.
Thank you. Councillor Munro.
Thanks, Provost. I'm happy to second this motion to make provision for withdrawing Midlothian from COSLA. It's incumbent upon all of us to take the tough decisions in order to balance our budget. It's clear to me that any benefits COSLA has will not come close to those that our constituents get out of the local facilities that are facing closure. This is about prioritising. Should we vote for membership of a Michelin star talking shop along with the free lunch for Midlothian councillors at the expense of the taxpayer? Or should we vote to put our constituents and communities first? This council should stand up for the people of Midlothian and vote to withdraw.
Thanks for that. Councillor Mulligan.
Provost, if it was as simple as what is being proposed here, we would all be putting our hands up to this. And while COSLA can have its flaws it's probably ideal to note that all 31 other local authorities are members of COSLA. There have been numerous times where local authorities have come out of COSLA at a very high cost to them, by the way, at a very high cost, and then had to come back in because they suddenly realised that they had no negotiating power and it was actually costing them just as much, if no more, to go out. Just in a rough calculation and discussing with the chief executive of COSLA, it's expected that if we tried to withdraw from COSLA, that would just simply be we wouldn't be attending. All 32 councils are automatic members of COSLA. The figure, just on shared pensions, with staff losses and other liabilities, would cost this council immediately around the area £450,000. Now, these are the figures supplied by Sarah Loudon, the chief executive of COSLA. COSLA has a real benefit to this council. We go in, if you take, for example, our national pay negotiations are done through COSLA, we would simply have to buy into that process. And I think we're talking a figure around £30,000 right away that we would need to pay for pay negotiations. And that's if we pull out whether or no COSLA would let us back in that door. So we could actually end up with national pay negotiations with nobody at the table. There are also numerous other benefits, and I'll give you one, for example, that advertising through My Job Scotland. COSLA have negotiated a settlement and a fee for advertising through there that is better than any other commercial rate that we get. So we would then have to find thousands of pounds again for stuff like this. There's also the added benefit to the fact that we're actually at the table in all negotiations, and I note that, for example, in the presidential team, Councillor Parry is actually on the presidential team for communities and wellbeing. Correct me, sorry, Kelly, if I'm not right. And it's actually, I think, to this council's benefit to have our councillors in high-up positions like that, that's actually in there. And I know they're representing COSLA as a whole, but at least they're getting a flavour effect for here. So therefore, the savings that we're actually talking about would absolutely be blown away with just the come out, and we would then still have, because it's an umbrella body that we've signed up to be part of at the start of this, we would still have ongoing costs for pension contributions and for ongoing costs to COSLA on top of that. So the savings, while the motion's meaningfully well written and probably looking there, when you actually go into the back of this, right away, we're talking about nearly £500,000 just to exit it, which blows out of proportion any savings that we'd get for it.
Councillor Hackett, you signed on this.
Thanks, Provost. In addition to the points that Councillor Mulligan raised, there's the principle of local government having a united voice in this country. We've spoken a lot about the budget pressures that we're facing. We're not the only council to have that, but as the second smallest authority, to go it alone in dealing with the Scottish Government, I would struggle to see how that is of any benefit to us as a council, as a corporate body, but equally the residents of Midlothian. My trade union role, Unison deals regularly with COSLA on pay, conditions of service and other important issues to the staff that work in local authorities, and I think it would be foolhardy to have our council withdraw from that excellent work.
Thanks for that. Councillor Parry. declare an interest in this one?
I probably should declare an interest. No, the only interest that I declared is that that I think COSLA is incredibly important, and I could not agree more with what the council leader and Councillor Hackett said today. And I think, I mean, the financial implications alone makes me question whether this motion is even competent, because this motion sets out that we would save money from leaving COSLA, and I don't think that's the case, not for the financial reasons or other reasons either. But the particular reason that I'm quite aghast at this motion is that there's clearly councillors in this chamber that do not recognise or value collective bargaining. And I think it's a very important point that Councillor Hackett just made about that. And some of the negotiations that COSLA is involved in, particularly pay awards for our staff and the other more in-depth work on education, on health and social care, on really important factors like universal credit and welfare reform, and dare I use the B word, Brexit, which you know, I think at a time where we're going to be needing to work more together and partnership with each other to believe in a fantastic, valuable body like COSLA is absolute madness. So I'm happy to say that the SNP group will also be voting against this motion.
Okay. Right, thanks for that. The motion is competent because we can't actually withdraw, but they could argue about the figures. I mean, that's the competence of the motion. Does anybody else want to contribute to this? Councillor Smale?
Yes, I mean, it is a simple fact that four councils did leave COSLA. And from Ms Lodian perspective, because we receive under the formula for local government funding inadequate amounts on account of the growth rate that we have, we are very much in a minority. Councillor Milligan has argued before with me in private that we could try for a more rational settlement for Midlothian, but we would be outvoted because most of the other councils are not in the same economic position. I don't believe the man in the street considers that COSLA has made an iota of difference to the efficiency of local government in this country. It has generally had a left-wing consensus agenda. It has resulted in collective bargaining with the teaching unions. The teaching unions govern education in Scotland. There are 52,000 teachers in Scotland. In the last 5 years, only four of them have been sacked for incompetence. Clearly, it is into the job creation culture of the bureaucracy of this nation. It would be much better if Midlothian were independent. In terms of the costs, as we have a policy of Midlothian first, it would be in Midlothian's interests to withdraw from a body that is not in our acting towards Midlothian's requirements in terms of the settlement with the Scottish Government. On the terms of the Scottish Government settlement, the percentage of local authority spending from the budget has fallen from 33% to 31%, and COSLA has been completely ineffectual in persuading governmental circles that the requirements of local government require, in fact, an increase because of the heightening problems of elderly poverty and elderly health. And the result of that has been a real terms cut by the Scottish Government for this council, a cut far in excess of what has happened in terms of Westminster Holyrood payments. Indeed, in recent years, there's been a real terms increase in the budget for Holyrood. This has been denied to Scottish local governments. COSLA has been completely ineffectual in fighting back in our favour.
Thanks for that. Councillor Alexander.
I don't agree with this motion because of what others have said, but I would actually much prefer to withdraw from the Westminster Government. And by doing this, we would be saving billions.
I'm sorry, that's nothing to do with the motion. I'm not allowing you to continue on that basis. I'm sorry. Right? I mean, I'm very lenient from the chair. That's not competent in relation to this motion about the Westminster Government. COSLA is a completely separate item. I'm sorry, so I'm not prepared to let you continue. Is there anybody else wanting to speak? As I say, I'm very lenient for the chair, but I'm not going down that road this morning. Does anybody else want to contribute? Okay, right, go to summing up. Councillor Hardy.
Thank you very much. It came as no surprise to me to see a group of councillors defending an organisation that is out of touch with the people it represents. COSLA has failed to stand up to the Scottish Government's cuts to local government, and COSLA does not live within its means. It lives in an expensive,
high-profile office in central Edinburgh, dishes out lavish expenses and lavish allowances to councillors. If it's not prepared to get its house in order, and Midlothian should be sending a message that we want to get our house in order, and by doing that, we should be withdrawing from COSLA, as other councils have done. I know other councils have been forced back into COSLA through negotiations between party political coalitions, but we should be able to look beyond that and say that we're putting the people of Midlothian first, we're making cuts that do not affect local services, and we're protecting services and jobs and standing up for the people of Midlothian and not standing up for the political agenda of a group of politicians. Thank you very much.
Okay, could I go to the vote, please? Now we've got the motion by Councillor Hardy and seconded by Kieran. Derek and Jim have moved a direct negative. So I'll take the direct negative first, which is to oppose the motion.
Thirteen.
And in favour of the motion?
Five.
Okay, thanks for that. Notice of motion 7.4, moved by Councillor Parry, seconded by Councillor McCall.
Thanks, Provost. Colleagues, it's 2017, and yet councillors don't have access to being treated like human beings and getting basic rights like maternity pay. Under the 2010 equality legislation, pregnancy and maternity is a protected characteristic, and yet for women who are councillors, we're not afforded protection from that legislation. The result is that women councillors either leave politics after having children, they fail to get adequate protection in the workplace through risk assessments after childbirth and pregnancy, and they feel pressure to go back to work early, which is a statistical cause of increased risk of postnatal depression. Giving women and men a choice in whether to take maternity or paternity leave does not take away the status quo option, but instead gives the flexibility and legal protections that haven't been debated in at least civilised society for a long time. We don't have enough women in politics, and the last few weeks have been a fishbowl into as to why that is the case, that we need more women in politics. And I think particularly in local government, council chambers are often the bear pit of politics, and some of them are deeply entrenched in misogyny. Of course, there should be provision for new fathers who want to take paternity leave as well. Parents and carers play a vital role in our society, and their experiences shouldn't be excluded or their voices unable to participate in our structures. This motion simply sets out an agreement in principle to investigate options that the Council could and should take in relation to this issue, and I hope that this Council can take a progressive leap into the 21st century and be the first Council in Scotland to move forward with a policy and actions that reflect the changing demands in local government. For the sake of our councillors now and in the future, we must send a message that women and parents are welcome in local government, and I very much hope that everybody can agree with me on that. Thank you.
Councillor McCall.
Thank you, Provost. I'm a firm believer that councils should be reflected off our community, and therefore we should be doing everything that we can to encourage people from all sections of the community to stand as councillors. And this motion makes a start on that. We need to be setting out maternity and paternity leave arrangements. I think it's fundamental, and I was actually quite shocked to start as a councillor. Not that I'm planning on going on maternity leave anytime soon. I'm really quite shocked that this wasn't in place already. And so therefore, I think as the council with the best gender balance in Scotland, it would be certainly a step in the right direction for us to go ahead with this motion. Thank you.
Anybody else want to contribute? Councillor Hackett.
Thank you, Provost. I agree with the principles of this motion. I think we should be doing all we can to encourage underrepresented groups in our community participating fully, whether that be as an elected member or other roles within the community. There is that issue about whether or not councillors are employees, but all that being aside, the principle, I think, is a sound one and should be supported. And if it means lobbying COSLA or Councillor Smale's independent free state of Midlothian, I'd be quite keen to do that. Thank you.
Okay, any other comments? Anybody want Councillor Hardy?
I welcome this motion as well and completely agree wholeheartedly with all the statements from Councillors McCall Parry and Hackett. I think it's right that if we are a great place to grow, as we're always telling everyone in Midlothian, that we need to show that we are committed to this policy, that we support the right to a family life and everything we do to help support that. And I completely agree that as a modern council, we should have modern practices that reflect the needs of people in society. And anything we can do to encourage more women and men with families to be involved in local politics, I think that's just a great thing, and we should be supporting this if we can.
Thanks for that. That includes lobbying COSLA, which is the last two lines of the motion. Huh? Okay, is there anybody else wanting to contribute? Okay, can we move to the... I don't think we need a vote. I think we've got a consensus here. Is that the agreed will of the council then, rather than putting it to a vote? I think that's a better way of doing it. Right, thank you. 8.1, Boundary Commission Review. Kenneth.
Thank you, Provost. The Boundary Commission for Scotland published its revised proposals for UK parliamentary constituencies in Scotland on the 17th of October for an eight-week public consultation period. Excuse me. In respect of Midlothian, the revised proposals are to change the proposed name of the constituency, in addition to add to the eastern boundary of the area of Cardrona, which would now form part of the new Midlothian and Upper Tweeddale County constituency. And full details are available in the members' library and also online. And members will also note there's maps showing the new arrangements at the back of the chamber. And now the Council's response to the revised proposals are sought. Those members that were here prior to the last local elections will recall that the initial proposals for the new UK parliamentary constituencies in Scotland, including the proposal to create a Midlothian and Peebles County constituency, were considered at the Council meetings on 8th November and 20th December 2016. Midlothian Council had no specific comments on these proposals at that time. Today, the recommendation is simply that Midlothian Council is invited to respond to the revised proposals of the Boundary Commission for Scotland. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone? Councillor Mulligan?
Provost, it's always been this Council's position that keeping the parliamentary constituency coterminous with the Council has to be of a great benefit. So I would actually move that the Council's position is that the Midlothian Westminster constituency remains coterminous.
Seconder for that, Councillor Hackett.
Thank you, Provost. I agree with that. I think, we've seen changes with our Scottish seats, which it's been and gone now, but I think the idea of Midlothian being one county and one electorate benefits all the residents. There's a wider issue for me, this idea of limiting people's voices whilst the House of Lords still sits there growing every day, and I know there's proposals there to reduce the House of Lords, but it's potentially will take generations before any of these changes occur. I can understand the public wanting less money spent at Westminster. I understand people's feelings around that, but sitting behind that is our representation in Parliament, in public life, and I think it's important for the people of Midlothian that we retain our seat.
Councillor Baird.
Thank you, Provost. There's within the report, section 2.3, there's what I felt was quite a concerning remark from a Tory spokesperson at the review that was held in Edinburgh, where they state that if it wasn't suitable to take wards 1 and 2 from the borders, that we could have ward 3, Gala Shields, instead. Now, that pangs of gerrymandering. And I wonder if any such offers have actually been uptaken from by other areas.
Okay, anybody else want to comment? What do you want?
Yes, I mean, the background, Section 2, sets out the first stage of the process. And during the first stage of the process, that was one of the pieces of feedback. And I think, to be fair, that's precisely the kind of feedback that the Commission was looking for. It was looking for different opinions or different proposals, and political parties across the country were involved in that process. It was at the end of that process, to which this Council decided not to contribute, that there's now been these new proposals brought forward, slightly amended, the only amendment being from the previous proposal, the addition of the 616 electors in
Cardrona. But I think that, as I say, the background, that was part of the first consultation. We are now entering a second period of consultation.
Thanks for that, Kenneth. I think probably one of my concerns is as well is that probably that political parties aren't involved in the consultation at all. You only have to look in the issues in America at the moment, where it's political parties that decide what the boundaries are. And that's where you see these problems come from. And I wonder if it's perhaps should be reviewed in the review, if it shouldn't be political parties that are invited, but instead just residents and constituents, because I feel it's their voice, not ours, that needs to be represented.
It is a public consultation, so anyone can contribute to that. What I don't have to hand is any figures about the number of contributions that might have been, either in relation to the new proposed constituency, including Midlothian, or indeed more widely in Scotland, but it is a public consultation. I think that the issue is that whilst political parties will contribute, they are not decision makers, because ultimately the local government boundary commission has that overall role.
You want to come back on that, or are you okay with that? Right. Okay, anybody else want to contribute? I take it basically agree that Derek, you want to sum up for your...
The only point I have is that they will look to keep the boundary code terminus because it benefits Midlothian as a whole.
Okay, is there anybody otherwise minded? Okay, that agreed position of the council. Right, thank you. 8.2, Edinburgh and South East City Region deal. Who's leading on this?
Thank you, Provost. This report provides a further update on the Edinburgh and South East Scotland City Region deal and specifically seeks approval for the proposed governance arrangements. The heads of terms for the city deal were formally signed on the 20th of July this year, and in summary, these confirm that both the UK and Scottish governments are committed to jointly investing up to £600 million over the next 15 years, which, when added to the expected contributions from regional partners, will represent over £1.1 billion of investment. The heads of terms are relatively high level in nature, and work is now ongoing in relation to the preparation and approval of final business cases for all projects and programmes, the development of a final city deal document and implementation plan, and the establishment of clear and robust governance arrangements, along with a number of other requirements placed on us by the two governments. Paragraph 2.5 and Section 3 of the report sets out the key elements of the city deal specifically as they relate to Midlothian, and the heads of terms are attached at Appendix A. You saw them previously at the Special Council meeting in July. Section 4 sets out the proposed city deal governance arrangements. The proposals are for a joint committee, a new cross-regional business leadership group, and an executive board to support the joint committee in the delivery of the city deal programme. The proposed arrangements for the joint committee are set out at a high level in Appendix B, but members should note that any decision to commit match funds and resources would be taken by the individual governing bodies. So this council will determine how its resources are committed at all times to any project. To formalise the process, it is proposed that a minute of agreement be prepared to set the arrangements out for the role, remit, powers and operation of the joint committee. And the details in Appendix B will form the basis of that final minute of agreement. There are no specific financial resources relating to the governance arrangements in themselves. However, the total package includes a programme management office, which is essential to ensuring that the programme runs effectively. These arrangements will require a maximum contribution from Midlothian Council of £28,000. Additional costs, estimated at about £20,000, will be incurred in the preparation of the outline business case for the A701-702 roads project. These costs, amounting to £48,000, will be met from general fund reserves set aside to fund costs associated with transformation. Today, the recommendations are that the Council agrees to establish a joint committee under Section 57 of the Local Government Scotland Act
1973, agrees that the Leader of the Council be appointed to represent the Council on a joint committee, that authority be delegated to myself in consultation with the Leader to negotiate and agree the minute of agreement establishing the joint committee, to note the costs of the project business case preparation and the project management office, and to delegate to me to finalise the necessary arrangements, and to require further and regular update reports on the progress of the city deal. Thank you, Provost.
Thanks for that. Councillor Rimley.
Thanks, Provost. Happy to move the recommendations that are in the paper today. And just to highlight, although originally we weren't terribly happy with the outcome of the final figure that was offered by both governments, and we were expecting an awful lot more, and we were also expecting it to be within the 10-year period as opposed to the 15-year period. Nevertheless, that boat has sailed, and we now have to get on with the real work, and I think it's really important that we get on as fast as we possibly can, bearing in mind that governance will always be remitted back to this council, as the Chief Executive has already alluded to. We are actually in a not bad place, believe it or not. Usually we bemoan about every other authority getting all the rich pickings and us being at the tail end. This time, actually, we are not in a bad place at all. There are other authorities that make up the Edinburgh City Region deal that are feeling rather wounded at this moment in time, because major projects that they thought were going to be part of the Edinburgh and South East Region City deal aren't there. So from that aspect, I think Midlothian, although not having it all, has actually got quite a lot of the pickings by being first in the queue. As far as the governance arrangements are concerned, I think it's right and appropriate that the Chief Executive and Leader of the Council play their part in that board. And I think it's right and appropriate that they will drive the agenda and make sure that all the items that are in the Midlothian context are actually up there front and hopefully, dare I say, implemented sooner rather than later. City region deals are the flavour right throughout the UK, never mind just in Scotland, and I think it's right and appropriate that we get on and we get the job done, and I'm sure that we will have lots of reports coming back to this council which will move this council forward and see, hopefully, the economic benefits coming to fruition that investment will bring with it. Thanks.
Councillor Muirhead, do you just reserve your... Right, OK. Anybody else want to contribute? Councillor Cassidy, Colin.
As Kenneth said, the heads of terms have been signed back in July and we're now in November. This is a very exciting development and we just want to see it gaining some momentum. And I was just wondering, when are we looking at the first set of meetings taking place? How often will update reports be brought to Council? And what do officers see as challenging areas in working across local authorities?
Thank you, Provost. In terms of the first formal meeting of the Joint Committee, I would anticipate that would be early next year. But I would emphasise that the leaders of the six councils involved, together with the universities and business representatives, are informally meeting on a regular basis to maintain an oversight of progress. I think it is a challenge working across local authority boundaries, but I think there's a strong shared commitment to moving this forward. I would have thought that we will be reporting to Council on a very regular basis, two or three times a year. That will depend a bit on the particular progress in relation to Midlothian projects, but we are keen to get resource into the A701-702 work, partly because that's critical in terms of the development of Easter Bush, and Easter Bush is one of the key development areas within the overall city deal. So I would anticipate that we'll be coming back on that in the relatively near future.
You want to come back on that, Colin? Are you okay with that as an answer? Right, thanks. Councillor Johnson.
I understand that there will be formal updates to the council, but after all, there is a meeting every month, and I think some informal update to the other parties in the council would be beneficial for us all. So could we put in another recommendation that we have regular or informal updates after every leader's meeting, please?
If the council wish to formalise that, that's a matter for the council. What I would say is that if members require updates or briefings from either Ian Johnson or myself or other officers involved in the city deal, they simply have to ask, and we will provide these necessary briefings.
Yeah, okay, that is a response. I think it'd be fair to say, I think if there's any developments, I think it'd be incumbent on the chief executive to feed it back to the leaders of the three parties. Obviously, it would be there anyway, so I think it makes sure everybody's informed. Okay. Right, thanks for that. So, agreeing the report? Okay, agreed by the council. Right, thank you. Item 8.3, end of year final audit. Kenneth again.
Thank you, Provost. The purpose of this report is to bring to council's attention the annual audit report to members and the controller of audit for the financial year ended 31st March 2017, prepared by the external auditors EY, and that document is attached to the report. The report was considered by the Audit Committee on the 26th of September. It provides detailed information on financial management, financial sustainability, governance, transparency and value for money. And much of this, of course, emphasises the scale of the financial challenge facing the Council and the absolute requirement for a robust and effective approach to dealing with this, as set out in recent financial strategy reports. And this is also reflected in the action plan at Appendix F. The Audit Committee noted and approved the report, and today Council is invited to note the terms of the report. Thank you, Provost.
Okay, Councillor Mulligan.
Provost, as the Chief Executive says, it probably highlights the importance of the budget challenges in front of us. And I think the one thing that jumps out for me here is it highlights the fact that where we do intend to gather savings from the Council, that we need to be monitoring them to make sure that they're actually achieved. And I think it's the one thing that jumps out here is the failure for us to continually achieve the targets that we're setting. So therefore, it's hoped that we now re-look at this and re-emphasise the fact when we bring forward proposals that officers need to do everything in their power to make sure that we're getting the efficiencies that we're asking for.
OK, thanks for that. Anybody else want to contribute? Okay, agree to accept the report. Right, thank you. Item 8.4, financial statements end of year 31st of March 2017. Gary?
Provost, this report presents the audited financial statements for last financial year to Council. Section 2.1 of the report summarises the changes identified during the audit process, and those are encompassed and within the EY report that we've just touched upon. Today, Provost Council simply asked to endorse the report.
Any questions to the report? Any comments? Okay, endorse the report. Thank you. 8.5, financial monitoring. Gary again.
Provost, this report sets out the projected performance against the revenue budget based on the first half of the financial year. Again, as set out in section 2.1, we project a net overspend of £2.135 million, which is equivalent to 1.04% of net expenditure. This is broadly similar to the overall position that we reported to Council in September, and the variations against budget across services are set out in section 2.1 of the report itself, and also in more detail in Appendix 2 to the report. Moving on, section 2.4 of the report sets out the projected impact of that performance on the general fund reserve position, with a projected overspend reducing the reserve to £6.846 million in total, of which the unallocated amount, the amount uncommitted, and a contingency is £2.102 million. Again, I'd stress these remain projections with the expectation from the Chief Executive that the action will continue within services across the second half of the year, aimed at improving the performance and bringing service expenditure within or closer to the budget. Again, Provost, the Council is asked to consider the recommendations which are set out in Section 4 of the report.
Thank you. Any questions, comments? Derek?
Provost, just to welcome the report and to actually welcome the fact that some of the budgets are now starting to go the right way and officers seem to be getting to grips with them. And adult social care, £328,000 savings pooled in there, and some other savings, even though it's still £750,000 predicted in overspend, it's actually coming down the right way. It was at £859,000. You can see some favourable movements, no least for the estimates on the government grant going up for about £500,000 in the estimates. However, it still leaves us in a massively challenging financial position, and very notably, every single division now estimating an overspend in this council, and I think that's the first time I've actually seen that, and that starts to get really worrying as to where why we've actually set this budget. However, Chairman, as a monitoring report, and happy to endorse the recommendations.
Thanks for that. Anybody else want to contribute to this one? Okay. Agree to endorse the report? Thank you. Item 8.6. Sorry, done my page here. General Services Capital Plan. Gary again.
Provost, this report provides an update on the capital plan. Section 2 sets out new projects to be included in the plan. And that's two from that were approved by the Council meeting on the 29th of August. Two which are grant funded, at Gorebridge Connect and Track to Train, and two other additions, one of which the addition for leisure management should have been brought forward to Council in June, but was omitted, so apologies for that. Section 3 sets out revisions to the existing 17-18 budget, which really just reflects the phasing of expenditure across financial years, recognising capital projects span a number of years. Section 3.2 of the report sets out performance against the budget, with the overall position summarised in Section 3.3. Provost, today Council is asked to consider the recommendations which are in Section 6.
Yeah, thanks for that. Councillor Mulligan.
Yeah, Provost. One of the main things that jumps out here is actually the government's ruined some of this here, and it's quite clear that some of this should have been here a long time ago. As I understand, the leisure management system that was approved in May by the corporate management team, and indeed we went down the road, it almost been through, and if no, we have a signed contract. The reality is there are some areas in that contract where I have a bit of concerns as to whether or not the spec of it is way over what we need. For example, the inclusion of the Public Services Network, PSN, system in there and what the cost of that would be. Now, I'm very much aware that we actually need the leisure management system in because we're putting some real targets into leisure and we're asking them to bring in an awful lot of money. But the reality is there's a question mark over the spec of what we're actually issuing here and the cost of that spec and what the cost of having the public services and network stuff in there would be. So can I ask that we're maybe furbished with further reports as to why that spec was there and what the likely cost of that is and what the need for it was. However, we're quite happy to agree to endorse where we are just now. But make the point really firmly here that these things should be up here a lot more timelessly.
John, Mr Blair.
Yeah, thanks, Provost. Well, hearing what leader's got to say, in terms of coming forward with a further report, absolutely no problem. Bring forward full details in due course. With regard to the governance, I'd just like to give the Council assurances that this has been an omission and echo Gary's apology. However, going forward through the Capital Planning and Asset Management Board, which I chair, every single capital project in this Council and every single capital receipt goes through that board before it comes on to the Council. So that's another safeguard we've put in place. So once again, I apologise for the omission, but I'll give the assurance going forward that all projects will be properly governed and come in front of the Council. Thanks, Provost.
Is there anybody else wanting to contribute to this? I'll give you the recommendations. Move forward on that basis. Right, thank you. 8.7, HRA account. Gary again.
Thanks again, Provost. So this report provides Council with a projection for our housing revenue account and the housing revenue capital investment is based on the second quarter of the year. We expect capital expenditure of the year to be £16.834 million. That's investment in new build and investment in the existing housing stock. The revenue account is currently projecting an underspend of about £1.281 million, which leads to a healthy year-end reserve position of £34.665 million. But members will recollect that that reserve has been built up to support the continued investment in new build housing. Provost, Council today is recommended to note the report.
Okay. Anybody else want to contribute to this? Okay. Councillor McCall, sorry.
Thank you, Provost. I'm slightly concerned about the universal credit implications in this report. It's mentioned that we are using assumptions. I think that was based on East Lothian's recent dealings with that. I'm just concerned that if there is going to be issues with universal credit, that is going to knock on to the HRA and that we wouldn't be able to spend to build as we had hoped to do so. Thank you.
Okay, I'll just see Kevin moving off the Sol's bench here, so I'll bring him in now. So.
Thank you, Provost. Relative to universal credit, there is a report which was intended to come to current council today. That's been delayed to December, and the reasoning for that is members may be aware over the past 10 days, every alternate day, there has been a change in the position with universal credit and announcements from DWP and from the government. So I didn't want an out-of-date report coming to council, so we're taking account of those changes and that will come forward to December council. But certainly in terms of Councillor McCall's point, it is a risk. It's indicated in that report that clearly the income stream to the council, let alone the individual hardship in terms of people's income stream, is a risk. And the worst-case scenario is, yes, it would have an effect on our borrowing requirement for capital expenditure and the house-building programme. But it's not at that position. It's early days relative to full service. But certainly the bad debt provision has been increased to take account of our forecasts, and it's within that at the present time.
Okay, does that answer your question? Okay. Right. Councillor Parry.
Sorry, Kevin, just while you're there. just on the issues of universal credit and just a little bit more about what that report's going to bring. I know in East Lothian, the types of reports that they've looked at has focused on rent arrears specifically, and I would be interested to know what the difference is, what the impact is for people in terms of rent arrears, because anecdotally I'm aware that the amount that people are due has substantially risen compared to housing benefit. So it would be good to see some detail on that. Could you let us know what is the rate that people currently have to pay back any rent arrears as well? Once they do get their universal credit payment, at what percentage do they have to pay back their rent arrears? Because I'm a bit concerned that some people who have waited a long time to get a universal credit payment find themselves in further difficulty because they're paying back sums of 20% in rent arrears when actually they've got payday loans, friends and family to pay back. They're behind on school meals and shoes for the kids and stuff as well. So if you have those figures to hand, that would be great. And if not, it would be good to see them in that report.
Thank you, Provost. Certainly, yes, the impacts, as requested, are detailed in the report. At the current stage of April, I can report back that on average, the arrears for a universal credit claimant were £740. In comparison, those in receipt of housing benefit were £299. So there's a considerable difference there in terms of the rate of debt that's been incurred on the rent accounts. Certainly in terms of the rate of repayment, Councillor Parry is referencing the alternative payment arrangements that are in effect by DWP deductions, not by the Council. In terms of any repayment of rent arrangements, we deal with those on an individual basis relative to individual circumstances. So we have no prescriptive rates of repayment for rent arrears. But certainly in terms of the alternative payment arrangements cases, then it can be up to 20% of recovery from DWP deducted at source. I don't have details on how many cases are affected by that at this present time, but we'll ensure that is in the December report.
So can I just ask further on that point about the payback rate? Does Council have any powers to change the rate at which arrears are paid back, or is that completely separate and dealt with by DWP? Because I think if there is some scope for councillors to have some influence over what people are paying back, particularly when they're in areas of severe hardship, then that, if that's a decision this council could take, then that's something that us as councillors would like to explore further.
There is a repayment scale from 5% up to 20%. 20% is an exception, as I understand, from DWP. As I say, I don't know about any cases that we have that that's being applied, but we'll get that detail for you. But it is in the decision, discretion of DWP, where that happens. Equally, they take account, I know, in terms of prioritising debt, because there may be, by the nature of it, a number of responsibilities and payments in terms of utility bills, as well as rent, as well as a number of other factors that are being deducted at source. So there is a proportion that is ascribed to each of those, which will not exceed 20%. So if there's one debtor, you can have access to 20% of direct deduction, but if there are a number of debtors that the creditor has to pay, then it will not exceed 20%. So there is a bit of variation that DWP apply themselves within that scale.
Okay, happy with that. Right, Councillor Baird.
Thank you. And I'm aware that the Westminster Government or the DWP climbed down on the charges for making phone calls to Universal Credit Lines, and I'd like to thank the MP's office for offering to take phone calls while that was going on. I just wondered what we were doing as a council to make it more accessible for people to contact Universal Credit and the DWP. Are they able to make phone calls and access internet via the housing office?
Yes, is the short answer to that. Through the offices at Buccleuch House, we give direct access to claimants. However, whilst they've certainly reducing charges within this month on the Universal Credit helpline, all the other DWP helplines are still chargeable until into next year.
Okay, that answers your question. Okay. Right, Councillor Johnson.
Well, these measures that the DWP and Universal Credit is forcing on our residents, how is that impacting on the recovery of rent arrears in the council, and have we got enough staff to cope with that, and how are actually they affected when they're dealing with some really upsetting stories from people?
Our rent recovery rate as of yesterday is 8.9% of rent arrears. That's gone up from 8% at the start of the financial year. So it is having an effect, as anticipated and as had been reported to members through various forums. That's happening, albeit that's not as severe a rate as other counter councils have experienced. So we're holding fairly static in that respect, but certainly the arrears recovery team are constantly dealing with managing Universal Credit. It's a continual process in dealing with both claimants and indeed with service centres, because there's not any one dedicated service centre that deals with a claimant. It's disparate relative to the service centres that are located around the UK. So that poses its own difficulties, clearly in terms of people's digital access and digital skills, because this is all done on an online journal now, which people will either access. Again, in Buccleuch House, we give public access within our libraries, and the library staff are trained relative to mentoring for these claims as well. So it's a difficult process that we're working through with people, particularly when they're making their claim. There is the period of six, I would suggest more 7 weeks, is the experience here locally, where people haven't got any income. So we're offsetting that through the welfare fund payments that we have control of through revenues, through the discretionary housing payment. And then ultimately, after three of those payments are made, we assist with food parcels, because there's nothing else available until such times as the Universal Credit claim comes through. I know there are anticipated changes there, and we will await and see what evidence of the change that makes for individual households. In terms of The impact on staff, we're conscious of that. We're looking in terms of additional support for resilience that we can provide in terms of the demands that that makes on individual staff because of the financial hardship that is evident within households that are waiting that period of time for claims to come through. And certainly I see a shift relative to my workforce planning for those who are dealing with housing benefit processing, which is a diminishing request of us, and the team shifting over to recoveries, which is an increasing demand on us.
Councillor Johnson.
Thank you for that explanation, and I just think that it breaks my heart that the welfare state is not managing to look after our most vulnerable, and I just hope we can all manage and muddle through this until times are better, and if there's anything that councillors can add to make life better for those folk in hardship, please let us know.
Thanks for that. Anybody else want to comment? Derek, do you want to sum up, or are you just quite happy moving the recommendations? Okay, that's agreed by the council, and obviously there's a few points been raised that Kevin will take on board for further reports. Okay, thank you. 8.8, Treasurer Management and Mid-Year Review Report. Gary again, is it?
Thanks, Provost. Provost, this report informs members of the Treasury Management activity in the first half of the year and the activity forecast for the remainder of the year. Section 3 of the report sets out some of the key economic activity for the year, and members will note that we've already seen some of that firmed up with last week's decision of the Monetary Policy Committee to increase the base rate. Section 4 sets out the activity for the Council's Treasury activity to date, which is in line with the Treasury Management Strategy, with Table 1 providing a summary of the Council's loan portfolio as at the 11th of October, with Table 2 providing a summary of the investment portfolio. Section 5 then goes on to look ahead for the remainder of the year and highlights that no further long-term borrowing is anticipated. Table 7 and 8 then give a projection for members of the position expected at the end of the year. Section 6 of the report provides members with an update on the prudential indicators, with Section 7 up providing an update to members on a range of other Treasury-related issues. Provost, today Council is asked to consider the recommendations which are set out in Section 10 of the report.
Thank you. Any comments on this? Anybody want to? Councillor Smale.
Yes, Gary, thank you very much for our dialogue on the question of Treasury management. As councillors will observe, perhaps the surprise of our constituents, we have £83.5 million in March and £88.7 million of cash on deposit or on various other instruments. That's Table 2. The first point is that we are in an environment where the turn we get on this is now very small. And you talk about a one-stage borrowing from putting a deposit with Bank of Scotland for 0.48% was what we were getting, perhaps raising money at 0.14. Are the frictional costs associated with this very large cash book reflected in the margins that are shown here? That's the first question. The second is, historically, the Audit Committee was quite exercised about knowing where it is we deposit money, and we discovered that there was a German bank we didn't know about, but that turned out to be all right. At one stage, we debated whether we should, under advice, as we always are, put money with a Qatari bank. I'm glad you exercised a judgment not to do that. I'm just wondering if the councillors could here and in the Audit Committee see a list of our depositories so that at least we can have a sort of second view to reassure us that our Midlothian cash is being put in safe places.
Gary, do you want to respond to that?
In terms of the frictional cost associated with Treasury management, we've recently got the Scottish Local Government benchmarking data back, which again shows that Midlothian's cost of average cost of borrowing and also expenses associated with that borrowing are combined are the lowest in Scotland, and individually the expenses associated with the Treasury management is still at the lower end. Excuse me. In terms of the investment of the Council's cash reserves, I'm happy to provide further details to any member, give you assurance that they are all within the scope and the boundaries set in the Treasury management policy, and happy to bring, when this report comes forward to Audit Committee, an update of the investments at that point in time of the morning of the meeting.
You okay with that, Councillor Smale? Okay, right, thanks. Derek, Councillor Murray.
Adam, I'm an aboutie. Peter's background and where he works, but I'm not actually sure the value of what a lot of elected members would get to that. Quite frankly, if you look at Appendix 5 and you actually see the loans fund rate combined, and that's interest paid by Council on money borrowed with interest earned from Council on money invested, you'll see that we're actually the best performing Council in Scotland and have been for some considerable time. I actually think it's one of the areas where I take my hat off to the finance team and say, well, congratulations. I didn't know how many years we've now been the top, but as far back as I can remember, I'm going to say 7, maybe 8 years, we've now been performing better than any other council. So I've got to be honest, I've got reasonable assurance here that we're getting this part right.
Anybody else want to comment, contribute? Okay, approve the report. Thank you. 8.9, the Lothian Local Development Plan, resolution to adopt. Ian.
Thanks, Robert. On 26 September, Council agreed its intention to adopt the Midlothian Local Development Plan. As required by statute, this intention was notified to Scottish ministers, who had a 28-day period in which to intervene. On 26 October, a direction from the Scottish ministers was received, notifying the Council that Scottish ministers are content for the Council to adopt the plan. In adopting the plan, the consequences are that the current 2008 Midlothian local plan would be superseded with immediate effect, that the Council will have a fully up-to-date local development plan, which gives it the optimal position in promoting and controlling development. It gives it the best environment in which to promote economic development, to maximise the provision of new affordable housing in Midlothian, and provides a strong context for protecting natural and heritage resources, as well as providing the optimal conditions for maximising developer contributions, which are so essential in such a fast-growing development area. Therefore, the resolution, the recommendation is to resolve to adopt the plan, and the other recommendations are the necessary procedural actions which arise from that.
Councillor Rimley.
Yeah, thanks, Provost. Happy to move the recommendations, but just wanted to make a few comments. Firstly, really just to say, when we adopt this plan here today, and hopefully we will do, just to put that warning out to everybody, including government, that we can't do everything through the local plan on our own. Infrastructure has been a debate in this chamber over many, many years and many, many times. General practitioners has been a debate within this chamber over many, many times. And quite clearly, we can't resolve that. We can agonise over it, we can get angry about it, but we can't resolve that. And I just say, right here and right now, over this video stream, if there's any government ministers or any senior civil servants listening, I make this plea to you on behalf of all of us. Please do something to help us out. We've got a city deal going through. We've got a local plan hopefully going to be adopted right here today. We don't have all the tools and all the instruments to deliver on all that's needed for our communities throughout Midlothian. Now, I don't know at the end of the day if it will fall on ears that are listening or ears that are deaf, but all I can say to those people out there is we need your help. We can't do it alone. We don't have the finances to do it, and even if we did, I'm not so sure we'd have the ability to do it. So therefore, please step in and help us. Secondly, and more importantly, the one worry I've had, and we've been very, very lucky up until now, is there's been only one planning application that came through that would have been in the local plan if it had been adopted quicker, and not our fault, may I hasten to add. The reporter decided to do 500 pages worth of script, and it's not our fault in that delay. But I tell you, that development in Bonnyrigg ended up going through by a reporter with no input from this council. Now, fortunately, It's come back to us to get everything tied up and everything resolved. But it could have been, like other authorities up and down the country, that a reporter grants planning permission and the authority doesn't have the kind of Section 75 benefits that we would have put in a planning report. And I happen to see, not far across the road from the Midlothian West members, Limekilns as it's now called, at the back of Birdie House there, the reporter put that one through and there was no Section 75 contributions called upon, and therefore there's a problem there on that side of the bypass where we're having to find Section 75 contributions on this side of the bypass. So I warn any members that are maybe thinking, Mel, to hang with it, the local plan isn't important. Oh, yes, it is. It's important for us to have an up-to-date local plan. It's important for our communities to know what's in that local plan. It is important for other outside bodies, i.e., in particular, government, to know that if we're going to grow Midlothian, we need them to support that growth. Thanks very much, Provost.
Thanks, Russell. Anybody else want to contribute? Colin?
Thanks, Provost. I'd just like to welcome this plan, the 2017 Midlothian Local Development Plan. I'd also like to thank my previous SNP colleagues and officers for the creation of this plan. Having looked over the maps and the literature, I can honestly say this has been a mammoth task for all of those involved in bringing it together, and I'm now looking forward to it being published. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that. Some of the local plan was agreed in 2005, actually, well, long before. So, what you said actually took place. Councillor Parry.
Thanks, Prof. I just wanted to reiterate that fantastically dramatic speech by Councillor Imrie, and particularly highlighting that point about that development that's really near Midlothian West, and dare I say that perhaps CES Plan would be an appropriate forum to take that into, and I'm very thankful that we have such a thing.
Thank you. Anybody else want to contribute? No? Okay, agree the recommendations to adopt the plan. Right, thanks, Ian. Thank you. Item 8.10, Strategic Housing Investment Plan. Kevin, back again.
Thanks, Provost. This report in respect of the Strategic Housing Investment Plan is now an annual requirement, which is why it's before Council today. This details our submission to the Scottish Government relative to the resource required for affordable housing investment. Also in terms of our own contribution, as has been committed earlier, to the Housing Revenue Account Capital Programme. Clearly this reflects on 1,000 houses that have been built in Midlothian since 2006 and is giving ambitious plans relative to the next 1,000, which need to be provided to meet the high demand and unmet need that continues within Midlothian and detailed in section 2.2 relative to the waiting lists for affordable housing. Within section 2.3 is the bid for the housing supply. That details mainstream and particular needs housing, as the increased provision of specialised housing is reducing inequalities for households and also is cost effective to the Council and also to the Integration Joint Board. Within section 2.4, the relative division of units and the funding requirement is noted in relation to our performance historically in the past and the allocation of affordable housing supply programme, as we do have a very good history in achieving that and also in the success of delivery. Section 2.6 is in respect of acknowledgement of the city deal. There isn't a great deal of detail, again, as has been reported earlier on the agenda today, but the headlines in respect of the housing workstream are there, and further detail would certainly be evident in next year's SHIP before elected members. Relative to Section 3, this details the funding requirements and also the proposed rent review, which is scheduled for 2018, to invest in the existing stock and also the continued new build programme. There are options relative to the rent premium which is being charged for new build housing and the
prospective change to the rent model, which is detailed in section 3.5. The council is required to consult with its tenants on a regular basis for the rent charge and the rent increase that they are required to pay, and we're suggesting that that's brought forward relative to the existing rent model, as the intention was after the 10-year period, there's a premium of 25% of the rent charge added, and to then converge after 10 years on a reducing basis to match the mainstream rent. The mechanism for that is particularly complicated, I'm conscious of just having said that, and consequently the rent options for consultation are detailed in 3.5 to take account of that in order that we can simplify that process, and also the effect of that income is projected in the chart, the bar chart at 3.5. We're looking to continue the consultation with applicants, housing applicants, as well as existing tenants who will be scoped into that, and the consultation reports results, would be reported to council. In addition, at section 4.1 and resource, the intention is to purchase 80 properties on the open market. This is to help housing need, either in existing estates or particularly in areas where there's a lack of development opportunities, where we ourselves will not have new build provision within our existing programme. And in section 5 are the recommendations to council in respect of approval of the submission of the SHIP to the Scottish Government, to the consultation exercise with tenants being carried out in 2018, and we would intend to bring that forward before the rent increase is scheduled for April of next year, on the basis of developing a fourth phase of new council house building. Also to approve the consultation on the variation to the rent model for the rent convergence, and to the agreement for the 80 purchases of properties on the open market. Thank you, Provost.
Okay. Any comments on this, Councillor Johnson?
Thank you. It's in item 3.5, and I wonder if there's a possibility to have an additional option, one where instead of reducing the rent for older property, older new houses, could we leave it the same until it catches up or catches down with the average price for similar houses?
Kevin?
Epps. That could be an option that we could certainly add in. I have to advise that in terms of the financial effects there are that it would take 7 years for an older property to meet the exact same value in terms of the convergence to the mainstream rents. And that's based on a 2% rent increase, which is what's currently modelled in for the new build programme. And I would anticipate after rent consultation that we would need at least a 4% increase for the purpose of continuing a new build programme into phase four, in which case instead of 7 years it would take 13 years to converge, and that really doesn't vary from where we currently are on the existing model.
Okay. Derek.
Provost, thank you. I actually think that's a good suggestion for Councillor Johnson, that you quite simply freeze the rents at that higher level after the 15 years and then let the older houses catch up with them. I think it's a lot more sensible than the period of reducing it. So I think it's an option that should be in there. As for a consultation on the 80 houses, I think, and I'm going to say this, Kevin, as well, I think we should agree the 80 houses. If there's a management or financial case for even more houses than that, then the reality is where the finances actually dictate that we would be better going and buying units rather than sitting waiting or using temporary units or bed and breakfast, etc. If it's financially viable, that's exactly what we should do, and officers should be freed up to take the management decisions, and I'm quite happy for that to go through on that. I'm at a loss at times why, when you see properties coming up in areas that if we do have the means to go and purchase the properties, if there is a demand for the kind of properties, why we're then paying massive amounts for bed and breakfast and hotel accommodations, etc., when we could actually have properties there. So I'm just saying, on a management view, I wouldn't have any problem where it's a spend to save, if that's the right word to do it, but certainly where it's financially prudent and for this council to do so, then that should be a management issue. When you actually look at this report, one of the real worrying things that screams out to everybody around this room is we're now at 4,925 people, and that's 4,925 families that's on this waiting list. We a population of between 80,000 to 90,000 people in our communities, and nearly 5,000 of them are sitting on the council housing waiting list, and yet we're the highest growing area in Scotland. We need to actually step up a gear here and start getting building with the reserves we're sitting with, and actually start to be looking at this. When I spoke to Derek Mackay, I made very clear I thought the contribution for the Scottish Government was very generous. I thought it was a generous sum that's been offered to us, and we should be taking the biggest advantage as possible. And if there's anybody at all, any other local authority that didn't want to get this money for Derek Mackay, Midlothian Council should be first at the door chapping it, and he was quite welcoming into that as well. I think it's a generous settlement, and we should be making best use of that settlement while it exists. So I would endorse the plan, and I would ask that we free up the officers to, if it's financially prudent for them to buy more than the 80 properties, we should look at it, and we should certainly incorporate Garth Johnson's suggestion in there in the consultation, that they simply freeze after the 5 years and then let the older properties catch up.
Okay, thanks for that. Anybody else want to contribute? John?
Provost, thanks. I want to make a general point, and I'm not having a specific go at Kevin here, because I think it applies across the council. We received the quality impact assessments for this paper and another one later on in the agenda yesterday. And this is something I think that happens quite often. You know, you're talking about a couple of days or the day before a council meeting, you get the quality impact assessment. It was certainly my understanding that the equality impact should be something that is built into the process of developing the policy in the first place. And therefore, I can't understand why we should be in a position where equality impact assessments are to follow papers and we're not getting them until a couple of days before. I'm not saying that is definitely the case, but it certainly would suggest that there's a certain element of it being an afterthought. Now, I'm conscious I'm raising this on a paper that Kevin's brought in, and I've worked directly with Kevin, and I understand his attitude to equalities is, I think, probably second to none among the officer corps. So I'm not having a particular go here, but I think it's something that applies right across the council and the papers that are coming before us, and I think it's something that needs to be addressed.
Thanks for that. Kenneth, do you want to respond to that?
Yes, I think the point is well made. It is important that equality considerations are part of the formulation of policy. I hope and I think that in most cases they are, and sometimes it's a bureaucratic exercise at the end that just doesn't get completed as promptly as it should. But I think as a management team we're very conscious we need to be on top of this, and there's improvements that need to be made. So that's a welcome intervention, and one that we certainly need to pay attention to.
Okay, thanks for that. Councillor Hardy.
Thanks, Provost. The issue that stands out to me is the lack of provision for low-cost home ownership within this paper. I mean, 43 houses. I mean, it seems if we're genuinely serious about having an equal local authority where we believe in true equality, we should be serious about saying people on a lower income should be able to afford and able to aspire to buy their own home and to get into home ownership. It seems like we're trying to create a situation here where Midlothian is saying, you know, it's an expensive place to live, Midlothian. If you have an above average income, you can buy a house, and if you don't, we're going to trap you in rent. And that seems completely wrong to me. That seems like it's sending out entirely the wrong message. We should be encouraging families to come to Midlothian and grow, and giving them the ability to afford to buy a first home and to start their family in Midlothian, and not trap them into rental.
Anybody else? Councillor Johnson.
In regard to what Councillor Hardy has just mentioned, do we know what the proportion of home ownership to socially rented housing is?
I don't know who's going to respond to that. Well, I'll give the officer a minute. I think Kevin's shuffling paper, so it looks like he's going to do it. So.
Thanks, Provost. Certainly, in terms of Councillor Hardy's point, I acknowledge that. We're certainly in discussions with our Scottish Government colleagues about alternative models other than social rented housing, and certainly that's what featured in part of the bid for the city deal. And as has been mentioned earlier, relative to the housing work stream, it didn't all necessarily transpire for the ambitious programme that there was there. In terms of home ownership, it is in the ship, I just can't find it right now, but it is around 80%. For Midlothian, and then social rented housing relative to the council is significantly behind that at around 20%, and then the RSLs are at about 8%, is my recollection. Sorry, here we are, page 12, and owner-occupied housing is 64%, council housing is 18%, and the housing associations, I did get right, are 8% of the stock. We're also looking at self-build. The difficulties with those other sorts of programmes is the demand that there is relative to the land supply and the funding of that, and we've made Scottish Government aware that we're quite happy to participate in other innovative ways of delivering housing, but it can't be at the expense of either our grant subsidy or in terms of the land supply, which is now limited, we're finding, to our own house building programme.
Councillor Parry.
I just had one question. Has the Council made any applications to the Scottish Government's infrastructure fund that's available to free up different parts of land that at the moment can't for specific reasons? I just wondered if we've made any applications and if they've been successful or if we plan to make any.
Yes, we have. They're detailed on page 37 of the SHIP for the existing infrastructure bids, but we have bid previously and again been successful both in Council land and for those for the housing associations also.
Okay, thanks for that. Anybody else want to get questions or happy with the report? Agree it? Two members.
Provost, just to formalise, I think we have a proposal that we change recommendation C to have the additional rent convergence option, and also from Councillor Milligan, that the 80 isn't an upper limit, but there's an ability for officers to go beyond that if that is appropriate. So I think these are, in effect, two amendments to the recommendations as they stand.
Okay, I'll just take that as being read as part of the agreed position. But anyway, we'll prepare to move forward on that basis then, okay? Right, thank you. Right, thanks, Kenneth. 8.11, period poverty proposal. John.
Thanks, Provost. At the August meeting of the Council, I was requested to prepare a detailed report regarding the issue of period poverty. In the report before you today, Section 2 sets out the background and the context. Section 3 details the proposed scheme based on best practice and guidance. The financial implications are detailed in the resources section of the report, and today Council is invited to consider the recommendations as listed in Section 5 on page 228 of today's paper, which includes writing to the Government via COSLA. And Council is also requested to note that there is no provision being made in the revenue estimates at this stage, and if Council were minded to support this proposal, it would require a supplementary estimate to be met from reserves. I'll pause at that stage, Provost, and if there are any questions, myself or my colleague Mary Smith will be delighted to answer them.
Okay, thanks, John. Anybody? Councillor Hackett.
Thank you, Provost. Since the Council debated this issue in late August, I believe the Scottish Government's announced a consultation, and that the Council's response is attached to that. We've been contacting officers within education, local schools, Women's Aid and other charity groups, and trade unions. There's obviously a problem for period poverty in our community, and it's about, with tightening budgets, where do we direct our resources to best meet that challenge? And the specific recommendations here are about schools. I note that presently schools do provide free sanitary products to pupils when requested, and I think I'd like to move an amendment that we agree all the recommendations subject to the funding being fully provided by the Scottish Government. In addition to that, just to make some changes to the Council's consultation response, and I'm happy to go through those. Just a brief one, changing 2A to 2B, which would be changing it from politician to a public body. At question one, feedback from local charities has been supportive of attempts to address pure poverty with the provision of free sanitary products seen as a positive step to tackling inequality. Answer three, remove existing answer and replace it with cardholders should have unlimited access to free sanitary products, as opposed to the limitation that's currently in the response. In terms of where the locations could be, to include pharmacies, charities that support children, women and families, and those that are currently C-card providers, and then to include the costs that have been kindly put together by the Director of Resources.
Thanks, John. In the meantime, John, I take it you're approving the continuation of free supply as it happens at the moment, the existing services. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, just to clarify, Provost, it's to say that, yeah, to continue the free supply as it stands at the moment, to respond positively to the consultation as my recommendation, and to agree the recommendations as laid out in the paper, subject to being fully funded by the Scottish Government.
Right, thanks for that. Councillor Johnson.
Thank you very much. I welcome this report as a start in our journey, but first of all, I don't think we should ever refer to these products as being free. They're not. After all, we never ever say when you go to the toilet, I'm going to use the free loo roll and I'm going to use the free soap and the free hot water and the free hand drying facilities. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say that. And we don't even refer to them as on the house or complimentary. These are considered the norm in all the toilets, whether they're public or private, and I believe the same should happen for period products. We don't expect to go to the loo with a kit bag, a loo roll, soap and towels, so why should period products be any different? Toilet products, regardless of who uses them or who purchases them, are free at the time of use. These are public health products that maintain our health. And as a result of the partial failure on the motion last meeting, I've been working with Midlothian Food Bank and Women for Independence. Women for Independence have also been in talks with a council officer who's made arrangements with WFI to have what we will be referring to as red boxes in all nine of the council's libraries, where all women can access period products with no charge at the time of pickup. And this will be done in conjunction with the food bank too. And we will ensure that as much as possible, these red boxes have a variety of products to choose from. So once again, congratulations for women doing it to themselves. We've also got, when I've been speaking to Women for Independence as well, we've got one or two issues about the Appendix 1. And we don't believe there should be a card-based system for products. That's hardly discreet, and we should be endeavouring to ensure that the provision of this service is as discreet as possible. And to single out poor lassies at the school, oh, you need an S card or whatever you're going to say, I don't think that's really any... I just think that inequality of that is awful. So in relation, in question three, so in relation to what I've said at question two, I don't think there's any need for that card scheme whatsoever. And in question four, yes, we're starting off with schools, but we would hope eventually that this would be rolled out to as many toilets as possible, making the scheme as universal as the toilet paper, soap and hand drying facilities, and should be freely available any time, any place. Because even the most well-prepared women can be caught out, whether you're a young woman or a menopausal woman. And they're probably the angriest about it all. Question nine. I dare say the removal of a luxury tax on this absolutely essential product for living, which is just the same as food, would be welcome. And I think the UK government could easily find a way to mitigate that. So perhaps a woman chancellor would see this better, as the male chancellors have obviously failed to do. And question 12, of course it can be developed sustainably. I can't emphasise how important it is that it should be considered like the loo roll, the soap and the hand drying facilities. And what's made me quite upset today, that it's been men in this chamber who've spoken about such a personal thing in a woman's life. It would have been good had Mary spoke about it and perhaps another woman councillor and not men. I just am disappointed in the women in the council have not spoken up more about that. And I hope that we can remove item D and the recommendations and redraft it in line with the discussions I've had today.
Anybody else? Councillor Barry? Sorry, Councillor Russell. Sorry, Margot first.
Thank you, Provost. I wish to second John's motion in the first instance, but wish to reflect on the fact that you're intimating that men are involved in discussing this and putting forward proposals. Well, men are fathers and husbands who will be involved in some way, shape or form and that this type of experience that women have. So I think it's just as appropriate for men to have the understanding of this particular problem.
Thanks for that. Right, Councillor Parry, then Councillor Smale. Councillor Parry.
Thanks, Provost. I just wanted to get some clarification because when Councillor Hackett moved that there, I thought what he was saying was that this policy was fine as long as this council didn't have to pay for it and that there'll be something going on in the background. But am I right in saying that you disagree with this until the Scottish Government pay for it? Because if you are, I think that that is absolutely appalling that this is the second time that this issue has come to this council chamber. And the first time it came to this council chamber, you were pretty much disgraced by your whole entire party, including Monica Lennon and other really influential women who have brought this forward. And I am absolutely horrified if that's what you're saying. And I can assure you that all the councillors on this side of the room will completely disagree with you because it is such a minimal cost in terms of what we're doing, in terms of our budgets and in terms of the contribution that it'll make and other areas of work that we do around attainment and making sure that kids are at school. So I'm hopeful that I have misheard what Councillor Hackett has said and that you're going to change your mind and that you're going to vote unanimously for all the recommendations there, bar the consultation response, because I have to say I don't know who put the consultation response together and I would like to know who put the consultation response together, because I have never met a woman or spoke to a young person who wants to be given a card that identifies them as poor or deprived, somebody who can't afford a basic sanitary item, to have to be given that to then go and speak to somebody in a school or a person of authority to go and have to beg them for sanitary items is a disgrace. So if I could get some clarity on the actual position and who put together this consultation would be good.
Well, Councillor Hackett can do that and sum it up because you've moved the position. Councillor Smale, then Councillor Cassidy.
Yes, I'm sorry, Kath, you really can't make a sexist comment that men have no right to talk on this issue. I have three daughters, a wife, and when I was young, I knew, was very close emotionally to a girl whose mother died, and she could not, for various reasons, have access to these products. I am, you may be surprised to know, very much in favour of action in this area. If anything, I think there is not enough financial provision in the numbers here, and I suspect the financial model requires a lot of scrutiny before we go forward. But on this simple principle, please do not divide us by men and female. From a libertarian point of view, we have the right, all of us, to debate these topics which are of public interest.
Councillor Cassidy, Colin.
Thank you, Provost. Just picking up on Margot's point, I'm a father, a husband, I had a sister, I have a sister. I did not know until about 2 months ago that women, young women, were going to school without sanitary products. I did not know that women were getting ill by using the same product over and over again because they couldn't afford to buy new ones. So to sit here and, as a man, and I'm quite a worldly man, and hear people saying that we are aware, I think it's wrong. I don't think any man in here would know what a woman goes through with this ghastly experience. So I'm sorry, I'm disagreeing with that.
Councillor Hackett, anybody else want to contribute? Right, well, I'll go to Boris here. Right, I'm really not very clear where we are with this. John's moved the position, seconded by Councillor Russ, by Largo. And I'm not clear what you've actually moved, Cathy. You can maybe clarify that just for the minute, if that's okay, please.
I've asked that recommendation D is removed. That's note the draft response to the consultation as appended, because I don't think it encompasses everything it should be.
OK, that's fine. Is there anything else you were pointing at taking out or clue? That was basically to remove D. Right, that's fine. Councillor Hackett, do you want to sum up?
So, Provost, I did ask for a couple of points of clarification as well.
All right, sorry, Kelly. Right, OK, right.
If Councillor Hackett's going to clear that up and he's summing up, then that's grand. But I would like answers to those two questions.
Yeah, I have asked him to do that, so, OK.
Thank you, Provost. With respect to Section D, can I make a suggestion that we have a cross-party group that works on the response? Because equally, I had suggestions from yourselves and other introductions. When I looked into this issue, I asked the specific question of education officers, how many pupils have lost school time due to not having access to products related to needed for having a period, and not one day has been lost, is my understanding, and I'm happy to stand corrected. It says in the report, presently school office or guidance teachers are able to supply sanitary products if requested by pupils at no cost. So in that respect, again, as little as the money is, and I accept that over a 44 odd million budget plus for it's 80 million for education, this is a dip in the ocean. But the difference is about putting the resources where they're required. And when we're looking at the current proposals, the consultations that are going out to the community, where some of these proposals are saving 4,000 here, 10,000 there, in my mind, it's about tackling poverty where it's most needed. And that's the thing. The difference is other councillors might want to grandstand on the issue of poverty. I'm interested in tackling it and putting the resources where they are required. Now, some of the points that Councillor Johnson were making was absolutely correct. This is a health issue. It's a community issue. It's not one that rests wholly or solely with the council. And if it's a health issue, if there is a Scottish Government taking a national initiative, I think it's incumbent on us to engage with the Scottish Government, support them in their efforts, and then use the resources that they offer local communities to tackle it. I spoke with Midlothian Food Bank as well, and the information I got from them that sanitary products are the ones that are most requested through their through toiletries. Women's Aid were more than happy to be a C-card provider. That was the exact information I got from them. So, look, I accept that people, the challenge that folk have living in poverty, this is one issue. It's one that we should be working on to address. But related specifically to schools, there is a provision already. We have the costings available, may need require more scrutiny. And we have the opportunity to work positively with the Scottish Government to tackle this issue. So my recommendation is to agree the report, but subject to being fully funded by the Scottish Government, and to remove Section D and propose that a cross-party group be formed to come up with a new report that can be sent to the Scottish Government.
Well, I really shouldn't have let you back in, but given us the subject, I'll let you back in, but if you could be brief, please, if you don't mind.
I'm being brief, and to be fair, I just want to sum up the position that we're at in light of the clarification from Councillor Hackett. The SNP group would like to move the recommendations as is on the paper and not with the caveat that it's paid for by the Scottish Government. We're happy to take on board the cross-party group to look at the consultation, however. But I would just say, this is your national policy, and for you to sit there and vote against it is appalling. My mind is actually blown. I think this is a huge mistake, and I would encourage, if you are going to have a free vote on this, to vote with the recommendations that are on the paper.
Right, so can I just have clarification from the committee clerk just exactly what we're voting on here, because I'm still slightly... John, I've got to ask Kel to clarify, but John, you're moving the recommendations, but instead of D, to have a cross-party working group. to take it forward. You're moving, Kelly. Right, which is for the government to pay for it. Right. Okay, that's fine. Right. Okay, everybody, are clear with that?
The recommendations as set out on the paper is without the caveat, just to be clear, and it's the Labour group that are moving an amendment to put in a caveat. So I just want to be clear that we're putting what's here on the council paper, that's what we are voting for, and it's the Labour group that are moving an amendment to put in an additional caveat to ask the Scottish Government to pay for it. Am I picking that up right?
My understanding is that Councillor Hackett is proposing the recommendations on the paper, removing recommendation D in favour of a cross-party working group and the funding being subject to Scottish Government funding. My understanding is that the SNP group are moving the recommendations as they stand, removing recommendation D in favour of a cross-party working group. Is that correct?
I can understand how I got a bit confused, because obviously Cath moved it and then you moved it the second time, so it's not that easy when you're sitting up here having to try and follow that. Russell, unless I've got something to...
Well, it's just on a point of order for the principle of voting here. Sorry, Provost. I can't understand it that the Council party is saying they're wanting to move all the recommendations. In recommendation E, it's quite clear that the Director of Resources writes to the Scottish Government via COSLA to seek additional funding. Councillor Hackett's just said additional funding, and yet Councillor Parry seems to think that he's saying something different. That is actually in the recommendation. So I'm seeking clarity of that from the wise people in front of yourself.
Well, we've got two. Just hold on, Kelly. Right? I mean, we've got two positions being moved, right? We've got the one for Councillor Hackett and the one for Councillor Parry. I'm just going to go straight to the vote. We'll take Councillor Parry's first, because it is an amendment in some respects, because John actually moved the report. So, those in favour of the motion from Councillor Parry?
But that's not the way the clerk's
Clerk's not chairing the meeting. Could I ask those in favour of Councillor Parry's, what card Councillor Parry's moving?
Six.
And those in favour of what Councillor Hackett's move?
Twelve.
Right, thank you.
Sorry, Provost, on a point of order, I'm sorry, but I don't think that that's correct. And I think I'd be right in saying that I need to raise that in this meeting right now. And can I get some clarification from the clerks, please? Because in recommendation E, when it says instruct the Director of Resources to write to Scottish Government via COSLA to seek additional funding, that is not a caveat. Councillor Hackett said there is a caveat that the Scottish Government pay for it. And I don't think the E spells out a caveat, and I would like some clarification on that.
Councillor Parry, when Councillor Johnson moved the position for your group, and then you moved another position following Councillor Johnson, I mean, that's not very clever from your point of view. And sorry, just let me finish. As I say, I'm trying to chair the meeting properly. One of your members moved the position, you moved something different. That's not the way to operate either. And it makes it difficult for everybody to actually try to comprehend what you're actually putting forward. It's a very emotive subject, and I fully understand that. I've got a family myself, I've got a daughter as well. But I'm sorry, when you're actually moving a position, if you could actually be clear on it, what you're doing, and not actually change it halfway through, and that's exactly what you did. Kyle, do you want to maybe clarify that? Because we've had the vote, and I'm not really wanting to take that. I'm not wanting to really spend any more time on this now. We've had a fair discussion on it. And it is an emotive subject, as I say. Alan, do you want to...
Well, I think the first point I'd like to make, Chair, is that I can see a difference between recommendation E in the original report and the caveat as proposed by Councillor Hackett. As I read 5E, it instructs Director of Resources to write the Scottish Government via COSLA to seek additional funding. There's no mention of what would happen if that letter is returned undelivered or with a negative response, whereas Councillor Hackett has carefully brought that scenario to the table, saying there must be a caveat that the seeking additional funding must be successful. As far as the matter of procedure goes, it is up to the Chair to the order in which the vote is to be taken. It is custom and practice that usually if someone is simply moving what is in the report, that usually comes first, but that's only custom practice. It doesn't have the strength of the full standing orders. Therefore, if you wish to take Councillor Hackett's proposal as the motion because he proposed it first, then that would be legitimate to do so.
Right, OK, so for some clarification on that, and as Councillor Hackett pointed out, I'm not going to drag this on because it is an emotive subject. I fully understand that. Sanitary products are actually being supplied free in the schools at the moment. I think I really want to stress that, and Councillor Hackett has actually said he wants that to continue, which is part of the motion that he put forward. Okay, that's us into private items now. Any, can I ask any members of the public or press to leave, please?